earth dwellers and children of men, must make our way to a destination already ordained, where the body, after the banqueting, sleeps on its deathbed. Then the due time arrived for Halfdane's son to proceed to the hall. The king himself would sit down to feast. No group ever gathered in greater numbers or better order around their ring-giver. The benches filled with famous men who fell to with relish. Round upon round of mead was passed. Those powerful kinsmen, Hrothgar and Hrothulf, were in high spirits in the raftered hall. Inside Heorot there was nothing but friendship. The shielding nation was not yet familiar with feud and betrayal. Then Halfdane's son presented Beowulf with a gold standard as a victory gift, an embroidered banner, also breastmail and a helmet, and a sword carried high that was both precious object and token of honor. So Beowulf drank his drink at ease. It was hardly a shame to be showered with such gifts in front of the whole troops. There haven't been many moments, I am sure, when men exchanged four such treasures at so friendly a sitting. An embossed ridge, a band lapped with wire arched over the helmet, head protection to keep the keen ground cutting edge from damaging it when danger threatened and the man was battling behind his shield. Next, the king ordered 8 horses with gold bridles to be brought through the yard into the hall. The harness of one included a saddle of sumptuous design, the battle seat where the son of Halfdane rode when he wished to join the swordplay. Wherever the killing and carnage were the worst, he would be to the fore, fighting hard. Then the Danish prince, descendant of Ing, handed over both the arms and the horses, urging Beowulf to use them well. And so their leader, the lord and guard of coffer and strongroom, with customary grace, bestowed upon Beowulf both sets of gifts. A fair witness can see how well each one behaved. The chieftain went on to reward the others. Each man on the bench who had sailed with Beowulf and risked the voyage received a bounty, some treasured possession. And compensation, a price in gold, was settled for the Geat Grendel had cruelly killed earlier, as he would have killed more had not mindful God and one man's daring prevented that doom. Past and present, God's will prevails. Hence, understanding is always best, and a prudent mind. Whoever remains for long here in this earthly life will enjoy and endure more than enough. They sang then and played to please the hero. Words and music for their warrior prince, harp tunes and tales of adventure. There were high times on the hall benches, and the king's poet performed his part with the saga of Finn and his sons, unfolding the tale of the fierce attack in Friesland, where Hnaf, king of the Danes, met death. Hildeburh had little cause to credit the Jutes. Son and brother, she lost them both on the battlefield. She, bereft and blameless, they foredoomed, cut down and spear-gored. She, the woman in shock, waylaid by grief, Hoke's daughter, how could she not lament her fate when morning came and the light broke on her murdered dears? And so farewell, delight on earth. War carried away Finn's troop of thanes, all but a few. How then could Finn hold the line, or fight on to the end with Hengist? How save the rump of his force from that enemy chief? So a truce was offered as follows. First, separate quarters to be cleared for the Danes, hall and throne, to be shared with the Frisians. Then, second, every day, at the dole out of gifts, Finn, son of Folkwald, should honor the Danes, bestow with an even hand to Hengist and Hengist's men the wrought gold rings, bounty to match the measure he gave his own Frisians, to keep morale in the beer hall high. Both sides then sealed their agreement. With oaths to Hengist, Finn swore openly, solemnly, that the battle survivors would be guaranteed honor and status. No infringement by word or deed, no provocation would be permitted. Their own ring-giver, after all, was dead and gone. They were leaderless, enforced allegiance to his murderer. So if any Frisian stirred up bad blood with insinuations or taunts about this, the blade of the sword would arbitrate it. A funeral pyre was then prepared, effulgent gold brought out from the hoard. The pride and prince of the Shieldings lay awaiting the flame. Everywhere there were blood-plastered coats of mail. The pyre was heaped with boar-shaped helmets forged in gold. With the gashed corpses of well-born Danes, many had fallen. Then Hildeburh ordered her own son's body be burnt with hnafs, the flesh on his bones to sputter and blaze beside his uncle's. The woman wailed and sang keens. The warrior went up. Carcass flame swirled and fumed. They stood round the burial mound and howled as heads melted. Crusted gashes spattered and ran bloody matter. The glutton element flamed and consumed the dead of both sides. Their great days were gone. Warriors scattered to homes and forts all over Friesland. Fewer now, feeling loss of friends. Hengist stayed, lived out that whole resentful, blood-sullen winter with Finn, homesick and helpless. No ring-whorled prow could up then and away on the sea. Wind and water raged with storms, wave and shingle were shackled in ice until another year appeared in the yard, as it does to this day, the seasons constant, the wonder of light coming over us. Then winter was gone. Earth's lap grew lovely. Longing woke in the cooped-up exile for a voyage home, but more for vengeance, some way of bringing things to a head. His sword arm hankered to greet the Jutes. So he did not balk once Hunlaving, placed on his lap, dazzle the duel, the best sword of all, whose edges Jutes knew only too well. Thus blood was spilled, the gallant Finn slain in his home, after Guthlaf and Oslaf, back from their voyage, made old accusation. The brutal ambush, the fate they had suffered, all blamed on Finn. The wildness in them had to brim over. The hall ran red with blood of enemies. Finn was cut down, the queen brought away, and everything the Shieldings could find inside Finn's walls, the Frisian king's gold collars and gemstones, swept off to the ship. Over sea lanes, then back to Daneland, the warrior troop bore that lady home. The poem was over. The poet had performed. A pleasant murmur started on the benches. Stewards did the rounds with wine and splendid jugs, and Walchtheo came to sit in her gold crown between two good men, uncle and nephew, each one of whom still trusted the other. And the forthright Unverth, admired by all for his mind and courage, although under a cloud for killing his brothers, reclined near the king. The queen spoke. "Enjoy this drink, my most generous lord. Raise up your goblet, entertain the Geats duly and gently. Discourse with them, be open-handed, happy and fond. Relish their company, but recollect as well all of the boons that have been bestowed on you. The bright court of Herod has been cleansed, and now the word is that you want to adopt this warrior as a son. So, while you may, bask in your fortune, and then bequeath kingdom and nation to your kith and kin before your decease. I am certain of Hrothulf. He is noble and will use the young ones well. He will not let you down. Should you die before him, he will treat our children truly and fairly. He will honor, I am sure, our two sons, repay them in kind when he recollects all the good things we gave him once, the favor and respect he found in his childhood. She turned then to the bench where her boys sat, Hraedric and Hrothmund, with other noble sons, all the youth together. And that good man, Beowulf the Geat, sat between the brothers. The cup was carried to him, kind words spoken in welcome, and a wealth of wrought gold graciously bestowed. Two arm bangles, a mail shirt and rings, and the most resplendent torque of gold I ever heard tell of, anywhere on earth or under heaven. There was no hoard like it, since Hama snatched the Brosing's neck-chain and bore it away, with its gems and settings, to his shining fort, away from Ermenric's wiles and hatred, and thereby ensured his eternal reward. Hujolak the Geat, grandson of Sverting, wore this neck-ring on his last raid. At bay, under his banner, he defended the booty, treasure he had won. Fate swept him away because of his proud need to provoke a feud with the Frisians. He fell beneath his shield in the same gem-crusted kingly gear he had worn when he crossed the frothing wave vat. So the dead king fell into Frankish hands. They took his breast-mail, also his neck-torque, and punier warriors plundered the slain when the carnage ended. Geat corpses covered the field. Applause filled the hall. Then Waltheow pronounced in the presence of the company, "Take delight in this talk, dear Beowulf. Wear it for luck, and wear also this mail from our people's armory. May you prosper in them. Be acclaimed for strength, for kindly guidance to these two boys, and your bounty will be sure. You have won renown. You are known to all men, far and near, now and forever. Your sway is wide as the wind's home, as the sea around cliffs. And so, my prince, I wish you a lifetime's luck and blessings to enjoy this treasure. Treat my sons with tender care. Be strong and kind. Here each comrade is true to the other, loyal to Lord, loving in spirit. The thanes have one purpose. The people are ready. Having drunk and pledged, the ranks do as I bid." She moved then to her place. Men were drinking wine at that rare feast. How could they know fate, the grim shape of things to come, the threat looming over many thanes as night approached, and King Hrothgar prepared to retire to his quarters? Retainers in great numbers were posted on guard, as so often in the past. Benches were pushed back, bedding gear and bolsters spread across the floor, and one man lay down to his rest, already marked for death. At their heads they placed their polished timber battle shields, and on the bench above them each man's kit was kept to hand, a towering war helmet, webbed mail shirt, and great shafted spear. It was their habit always and everywhere to be ready for action, at home or in the camp, in whatever case and at whatever time the need arose, to rally round their lord. They were a right people. They went to sleep. And one paid dearly for his night's ease, as had happened to them often, ever since Grendel occupied the gold hall, committing evil until the end came, death after his crimes. Then it became clear, obvious to everyone once the fight was over, that an Avenger lurked and was still alive, grimly biding time. Grendel's mother, monstrous hell bride, brooded on her wrongs. She had been forced down into fearful waters, the cold depths after Cain had killed his father's son, felled his own brother with a sword. Branded an outlaw, marked by having murdered, he moved into the wilds, shunned company and joy. And from Cain there sprang misbegotten spirits, among them Grendel, the banished and accursed, due to come to grips with that Watcher in Heorot, waiting to do battle. The monster wrenched and wrestled with him, but Beowulf was mindful of his mighty strength, the wondrous gifts God had showered on him. He relied for help on the Lord of all, on his care and favor. So he overcame the foe, brought down the hell brute. Broken and bowed, outcast from all sweetness, the enemy of mankind made for his death den. But now his mother had sallied forth on a savage journey, grief-racked and ravenous, desperate for revenge. She came to Heorot. There, inside the hall, Danes lay asleep, earls who would soon endure a great reversal once Grendel's mother attacked and entered. Her onslaught was less only by as much as an Amazon warrior's strength is less than an armed man's when the hefted sword, its hammered edge and gleaming blade slathered in blood, raises the sturdy boar ridge off a helmet. Then in the hall, hard-honed swords were grabbed from the bench, many a broad shield lifted and braced. There was little thought of helmets or woven mail when they woke in terror. The hell dam was in panic, desperate to get out, in mortal terror the moment she was found. She had pounced and taken one of the retainers in a tight hold, then headed for the fen. To Hrothgar, this man was the most beloved of the friends he trusted between the two seas. She had done away with a great warrior, ambushed him at rest. Beowulf was elsewhere. Earlier, after the award of the treasure, the Geat had been given another lodging. There was uproar in Heorot. She had snatched their trophy, Grendel's bloodied hand. It was a fresh blow to the afflicted Bonn. The bargain was hard, both parties having to pay with the lives of friends. And the old lord, the gray-haired warrior, was heart-sore and weary when he heard the news. His highest-placed adviser, his dearest companion, was dead and gone. Beowulf was quickly brought to the chamber. The winner of fights, the arch-warrior, came first footing in with his fellow troops to where the king in his wisdom waited, still wondering whether Almighty God would ever turn the tide of his misfortunes. So Beowulf entered with his band in attendance, and the wooden floorboards banged and rang as he advanced, hurrying to address the prince of the Ingwins, asking if he'd rested since the urgent summons had come as a surprise. Then Hrothgar, the shielding's helmet, spoke. "Rest! What is rest? Sorrow has returned. Alas for the Danes! Asherah is dead. He was Ermenlaf's elder brother, and a soulmate to me, a true mentor, my right-hand man when the ranks clashed and our boar crests had to take a battering in the line of action. Asherah was everything the world admires in a wise man and a friend. Then this roaming killer came in a fury and slaughtered him in Heorot, where she is hiding, glutting on the corpse and glorying in her escape, I cannot tell. She has taken up the feud because of last night, when you killed Grendel, wrestled and racked him in ruinous combat, since for too long he had terrorized us with his depredations. He died in battle, paid with his life, and now this powerful other one arrives, this force for evil, driven to avenge her kinsman's death. Or so it seems to thanes in their grief, in the anguish every thane endures at the loss.